Good Show, Good Podcast. Subscribe to Podcasts of Good Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand. Jeff Blair is the closest thing we have to a resident psychic, which is easy to say when psychics aren't real. This is the Jeff Blair Show. We see sports talk in your future now on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Golden State Warriors. Through all the championships and the finals appearances. It's not always about Steph Curry and Kevin Durant. Through it all, it's been largely about Klay Thompson as well. You know about Draymond Green. Draymond Green is an Iron Man, but he wasn't around for Game 5 of the 2016 finals. You remember that. He was suspended. Kevin Durant, of course, missed a whack of time. He wasn't there even when the Golden State Warriors started this run. And Steph Curry, God love him, has been banged up time and time again in the postseason and the regular season. He was even ill on Sunday. Klay Thompson, though, Klay Thompson hasn't ever missed a playoff game. He's missed fewer than 10 games every regular season he's been in the league. I mean, he seldom misses any in these days of load management. And we're talking about somebody who logs a lot of minutes for the Golden State Warriors. Now, Thompson wasn't around for the end of Game 2 because of the hamstring injury that has some saying he's questionable. And, well, basically, we saw how that played into the Raptors' hands, right? I mean, the Raptors essentially ran a box and one, focusing on Steph and letting the other Warriors beat them, which you can do, you'd think, without Klay Thompson. Fortunately for the Raptors in this particular game, Andre Iguodala was of a different mind. We know about that big shot. You know, Steve Kerr said after the game when he's asked about Thompson that he would have to be half dead to not play. Or I think he said he'd play even if he was half dead. Either way, you get the point. It's why I'm taking this chatter that Klay Thompson is questionable for tomorrow's Game 3 with a considerable grain of salt. But even beyond that, I don't know, right? Kevon Looney's out for the series with a fractured collarbone, and he was steamrolled by Kawhi Leonard. Andre Iguodala's still limping. Now Thompson. The series is 1-1. But, man, it sure seems as if the Raps have already won the attrition sweepstakes, doesn't it?
The Jeff Blair Show is on the air on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Join the conversation with Jeff on Twitter using the hashtag Blair Show or call 416-870-0590. Now, here's Jeff Blair.
Game 3 of the Raptors and Warriors tomorrow on Sportsnet Ontario. Tip-off is just after 9 o'clock. Both teams will work out today. There will be a media availability in the afternoon. We will have you covered all the way through the day on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We've also got tickets to give away to Raptors-Warriors Game 5, and we're asking you to listen all day for the keywords to text us for your chance at lower bowl tickets to Game 5 of the NBA Finals. That's right. All you have to do is text 590-590 right now with the keyword Anunoby 3. That's all one word with a capital A, A-N-U-N-O-B-Y, 3. Considering the spellings we had for Lowry yesterday, I'm fascinated to see how the hell some of you are going to spell Anunoby. Anyhow, Anunoby 3, all one word with a capital A, your shot at seeing the Raptors in their first ever NBA Finals host the Golden State Warriors, brought to you in part by Tangerine, the official bank of the Toronto Raptors and their fans. standard message and data rates apply. Go to sportsnet.ca/590 for full details. I cannot wait to go on and see how people are spelling Ananobi. I said there's no space between the Y and the numeral 3. Basically, it's capital A, small N. Jesus, I sound like I'm talking to my daughter. Capital and like 15 years ago. Capital A, small N, small U, small N, small O, small B, small Y with 3. That's the numeral 3. Do not write out 3. There. Dwight Walton's assistant basketball coach at Concordia University, former Canadian national team player. We know him as B-Ball Insider on Twitter. Dwight Walton joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. How you doing, Dwight?
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing today?
I'm doing well. Sorry you had to listen to that, but we've had some fans that have been struggling with basic spelling here. But that's okay. That's okay. People are excited. I get it. It's
absolutely
fine. So let's talk about the wounded Golden State Warriors. From a coaching point of view, Klay Thompson's going to play. I mean, until he doesn't show up, I'm just going to assume that he's going to play because that's kind of the way Klay Thompson's wired. But Dwight, if he is limited in any way, and we all know what hamstring injuries can be like, if he is limited in any way, coupled with what we think will still be the absence of Kevin Durant, how does Steve Kerr go about managing this situation? Because it certainly did appear as if Klay Thompson's absence in the fourth quarter played into the Raptors' hands.
Well, here's the deal. If Steph Curry thought he saw a janky defense in the second half of that game, what do you think he's going to see in Game 3 on Wednesday in Oakland? The best case scenario for the Raptors here is to double-team Steph Curry everywhere he is and make somebody else beat you. And I do understand what Steph Curry says when he says, talking about, I do understand the disrespect that players like Andre Iguodala and Draymond Green get on the offensive end. But the reality is they don't shoot the ball as well as Steph Curry and Klay Thompson does. So Draymond Green is a great, great playmaker once he gets that ball off the defensive backboard or if he gets the ball at the free throw line when Steph Curry gets double teamed. But those guys are not great 3-point percentage shooters. So you take your chances with other players beating you, and I think that's the dilemma right now that Steve Kerr has if Klay Thompson does not play in Game 3 on Wednesday and if Kevin Durant doesn't return until the earliest Game 4. Now, having DeMarcus Cousins in the lineup sort of alleviates that offensive pressure off of Steph Curry. But the reality is he is not Klay Thompson and he's not Kevin Durant. So it's going to be even more tough for Steph Curry and the Warriors to go forward here if Klay Thompson doesn't play on Wednesday.
Klay Thompson is kind of the guy that gets overlooked in all this, right? I mean, he's the guy who didn't make the All-NBA team and was famously, well, he was upset because it cost him a great deal of money. It cost him the possibility potentially of being a max player under the NBA's rules. But he's not Steph, and he's certainly not Kevin Durant, but there people do tend to underestimate Klay Thompson, don't they? It's almost as if he's viewed as if being the third of the three Musketeers, which I don't think is necessarily fair to him.
And I think he is the third wheel, if you will, on the Warriors, but he's not applauded or lauded as much as the other two because he's not as good as the other two.
Okay.
He's a great shooter. He's a great defensive player. He's one of the better two-way players that we have in the NBA, but he's not a player that we say that could put the ball on the floor and be creative offensively. He's more of a catch-and-shoot player. He could put the ball on the floor for one or two dribbles because you have to respect his jump shot on the perimeter, so he can pump fake, take two dribbles to create space and make a shot. But he is not a player that we're going to give the ball to and say, Klay, get us a basket here. He's famous for a player that scores on as little amount of dribbles as possible. He's one of the more efficient players that we have in the NBA. If you recall, he scored 60 points in 29 minutes on 11 dribbles in one game. I believe it was against the Chicago Bulls, I believe. Mm-hmm. So that's the type of player he is. He's not your creative offensive player, so he will always be considered to be the third wheel on the Golden State Warriors roster.
So if you're Steve Kerr, you know, and you're looking at this situation, and again, let's assume that Klay Thompson is more limited than he might be in the very least. And you're looking at this situation as a head coach. You know, you saw that you had a little bit of success in the fourth quarter, going big. You had Andrew Bogut in the game. You know, you got a lot of work out of Quinn Cook that you may not have expected, but is there a chance that Steve Kerr might have to go a little bigger with Klay out of the lineup, or how can he kind of make it work with Quinn Cook and Steph Curry on the court at the same time for a prolonged period of time?
Well, it is an embarrassment of riches for Steve Kerr. Whether these are household names or not, he can throw players like Jonas Jeremko into the game, Alphonso McKinney, Quentin Cook, as you mentioned. He can go to his third center in Andrew Bogut. They can go big. This is how great that Warriors roster is. And Steve Kerr has done a fantastic job of empowering the role players. They feel just as important as Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, Draymond Green, Kevin Durant, etc. That's the beauty of this team. And the way they share the ball offensively, how they backdoor cut, how they screen, they make sure they put a body on somebody offensively to get their teammates open. That's the beauty. Steve Kerr can throw anybody into the game, and it seems to work. And that's why the Warriors are so successful, even when their dearth of talent is limited to an injury.
In that game on Sunday, in Game 2, the Golden State Warriors had, 34 assists and 34 made field goals. What does that tell you about the Golden State Warriors? And what does that say about what Toronto may or may not want to do defensively?
Well, that's the problem. When you have such a great team with great players who check their egos at the door and they're going to do whatever it takes to win, not games, but championships, that's why they've been so successful. As you said, they had 34 assists on 38 made field goals. And once you see the basket go in, it even gives you more confidence. And what that does, it also makes you play better defensively as well. If you touch the ball on the offensive end, you feel like you're a part of the team. And that's what's great about the Golden State Warriors. We can focus on how great they are offensively all the time because they are, but we tend to forget that they're one of the best teams defensively in the NBA as well. So it goes both ways. They're connected on both ends of the floor, and that's why it's tough to play them. As I said, they're backdoor cuts. They do it with a purpose. They don't jog through their cuts. They screen. Steph Curry is one of the best screeners in the NBA. That's why he gets open all the time. Besides his movement off the ball, he's a great screener. And when his teammates see him setting great screens, they want to set great screens as well. And that's why the ball gets shared on the offensive end. And that's why they're so successful, even when the best players aren't playing.
All right, we've talked largely about the Golden State Warriors. I want to talk about the Raptors, Dwight. And you know, look, I think thinking was going into the two games in Toronto, Golden State wanted a split. I mean, it's the old road, you know, thinking on the road, get a split in the road, come home. But if you're the Raptors and you're looking at the videotape of those two games, you're probably saying to yourself, look, we were the better team for 7 of 8 quarters, maybe even a little more than that. I mean, that 18-0 run in the third quarter was just sick. I mean, that's, you know, it was historically great. What are the Raptors thinking with, like, if you're Nick Nurse and you're aware of the injuries your opponent is suffering or is dealing with right now? You still don't change anything because of that, do you? You don't try to do you try to pick at a certain area because of that, or do you sort of try to stay true to your principles, at least at the start of the game, and then kind of play off that?
Well, the reality, Jeff, is that they have been the better team in 7 of the 8 quarters. And we do have to understand that in this playoff run, the Golden State Warriors have outscored their opponent in the third quarter by a plus 135. So that's just the reality. They're a great team coming out of the locker room. And it reared its ugly head in game two against the Raptors. They were outscored 34-21 in that third quarter, including a 27-3 run that pretty much killed the game for the Raptors, in which they pretty much dominated. So if they can correct that third quarter, I think they have a great chance to win game three on Wednesday. They only had 17 assists themselves on their 34 made field goals, I believe. But that was due in part some to the Warriors' great defensive scheme, but they had missed a whole lot of wide-open shots as well. And the hope is that the role players who normally play better at home will come to the party on the road in either game three or four so they can regain home court advantage. So I don't think Nick Nurse has to change all that much. He just has to be very aware of how the Warriors play coming out of the locker room at halftime and to continue to take care of the ball, continue to dominate the offensive glass, and as the old adage says, it's a make or miss league. Just make some more shots, and you'll give yourself a chance to win down the end of the game in game three.
So would you expect to see, if Klay can't play, do you expect to see essentially the box and one? I mean, it seems odd. You know, we tend to think of the box and one as being a little bit of, you know, sort of almost old schoolish or something like that. But essentially, it's the best defense. If Klay Thompson isn't on the court and Kevin Durant isn't out there, it's the best defense for this, isn't it?
It's the same thing, Jeff, that the Warriors are applying to Kawhi Leonard. They want to take the ball out of his hands and make the other players beat you. Same with Nick Nurse and the Raptors. They're going to want to take the ball out of Steph Curry's hands. And if the other players beat you, you can live with that. That's mm-hmm. just the way it is. You can't take everything away in the NBA, but you would much prefer role players beat you than allowing their best player to beat you. So as I said at the beginning of this segment here, if Steph Curry thought he saw a janky defense in game two, it's going to be even more of a janky defense if Klay Thompson, even if he plays, he's not going to be 100%. And they're going to want to see if he can make plays along with Draymond Green and Iguodala, to see if those players can beat them in game three.
Dwight, it was good of you to do this. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeff. Have a great day. Enjoy game three.
I shall. You too. That's Dwight Walton, assistant basketball coach at Concordia University, former Canadian national team player. And there you go. Game three, Raptors and Warriors tomorrow night, 9 o'clock tip-off on Sportsnet Ontario. Now, we're going to be joined later on in the show by Ronnie Nunn. He's founder of Nunn Better Refs. He's a former NBA referee and director of officials. And we know that officiating is always a topic of conversation in every sport. It certainly is in the NBA. And this is interesting. I mean, I'm not a fan of the last two-minute report that the NBA sends out generally, because I think referees have a difficult enough job. And, if the referees know that they've screwed up, or if the league wants to tell the referees they've screwed up, that's fine. I'm not a big fan necessarily of making it public. But if you look at the last two-minute report, or the LTMR, from game two, the report shows that a call was missed, a key call was missed. Remember the final seconds of the game, the Warriors' possession that led to Iguodala's three-pointer. It was a long-range shot from the wing, essentially put the game away. The report says that during the Warriors' final possession at the 15.3-second mark, quote, Curry lifts his foot after receiving the pass. If the whistle had been blown, the Raptors would have gotten the ball. They would have been down two with 15.3 seconds left. Instead, of course, the possession led to Iguodala's three-pointer. Now, if you're sitting there fuming about that, the report also showed that the Raptors benefited from a couple of missed traveling calls when Siakam and Leonard lifted their pivot feet while in possession of the ball. That was in the final minute of the game. So, you know, the idea that that it doesn't even out is entirely wrong. Now, admittedly, a call in the final play, essentially the final scoring play of the game, is maybe a little more significant than a call that was missed 30 seconds earlier. But we'll talk to Ronnie Nunn about that and just sort of what it's like to referee in the age of the last two-minute report. And that'll be at 11:30. Ben Nicholson-Smith joins us at 11. He's baseball editor of At the Letters, or At the Letters podcast. And he's co-host on co-host of the At the Letters podcast and baseball editor at sportsnet.ca, the Keith Law had a great tweet on the Blue Jays draft pick yesterday, saying that essentially by picking a 6'6 pitcher, he said they've now almost completed their offensive line to go along with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. So we'll talk to Ben about that. Gord Stellick joins us at 10:35. The St. Louis Blues have tied the series with the Boston Bruins, a 4-2 win. And we'll also talk to Ben about the Yankees in town for a three-game series against the Jays starting tonight on Sportsnet. But we want to go to the phone lines of 416-870-0590, star 591, 888-666-0590. 590-590 is the text line. Please feel free to weigh in while you're sending in Ananobi 3. All right. I'm looking at this for our contest, Travis. There are still people sending Lowry 7 in. I have Ananobi 3. Ananobi 3. Okay, now you're trolling me. Ananobi 3. Yes, the people who, I love phonetical spelling. Anyhow, 416-870-0590, star 591, 888-666-0590. Raptors and Golden State Warriors, game 3 tomorrow night in Oakland. As I mentioned, we know that the injury bug has really bitten in on Golden State. Klay Thompson, the latest injury. You know, we know Andre Iguodala has been limping. You know, Steph Curry had the flu. Of course, Kevin Durant is out of the lineup. And Kevon Looney, we mentioned, probably done for the rest of the series after he was steamrolled by Kawhi Leonard. I think we've underestimated a lot this year just how physically tough the Raptors can be. I don't think we're comfortable necessarily thinking them of that type of team. But through the postseason, they have been really, really physical. They pushed Giannis around a bit. They were really into Steph Curry in game one. I mean, Fred VanVleet in particular was really into Steph Curry in game one. There is a physical element to this team that I think perhaps we've overlooked. And I, you know, I've always believed that when you get to this stage of any final, there is an aspect of toughness to your game. You know, it may not manifest itself but by collecting opposing teams' injuries or, you know, putting opposing players out. But there's a toughness to this Raptors team that I think we often overlook. And we're seeing it in this series. I mean, the Looney injury was all Kawhi Leonard. Klay Thompson was a little more of just a guy falling awkwardly. This is a physical team. And it'll be interesting to see if indeed Golden State is forced to use kind of a janky lineup, to borrow a word from Steph Curry in game 3. It'll be interesting to see how much of a physical game that game turns out to be as well. And as I said, I just think we underestimate the toughness and the physicality of this Raptors team. So again, the number is 416-870-0590, star 591, 888-666-0590. 590-590 is the text line. What do the Raptors have to do to win game 3 in your mind? I think we can all agree that the Golden State Warriors were happy leaving Toronto with a split. I don't know if I necessarily buy into the whole it was an opportunity missed conversation around the Raptors. Because I don't know if it was an opportunity missed. It seems to me Golden State won that game fair and square. Golden State went on that third quarter run. I mean, that's something Golden State always does. If Golden State had won the game doing something remarkable that we've never seen it do before, then perhaps I would look at it as a missed opportunity. but I just saw a multiple champion team, a team that has stood the test of time, knowing what to do down the stretch. I don't think that's a lost opportunity at all for the Raptors. I think we tend to view every loss in the postseason as a lost opportunity. This wasn't a lost opportunity. That's that narrative is a little too easy to fall into. Billy and Markham, you're on Sportsnet 590 Fan. What's up, Billy?
Hey, Jeff. Yeah, listen, to put it simply put, Golden State went on a run, and I'm hearing a but yeah, Golden State goes on a run, and you beat anybody in the world when you go on that run. I know Golden State's the champs, and I know that they're capable of doing that, but they're also capable of not shooting good. And Jeff, as I mentioned to you before the playoffs started, that when I told you there was going to be a party down on Yonge Street, that was with everybody healthy with Golden State. Jeff, there is no excuses now.
Mm-hmm.
This Golden State team is beat up. The Golden State will not come back here and beat us. I don't care if we lose game three. We got to win one game in Golden State, and we're going to be the champs. I'm going to tell you that right now. Simple as that. The Raptors are better only because this Golden State team is just decimated by injuries. No excuses. I don't want to hear if Golden State wins this. I will be so disappointed if the Raptors don't win this. And about my gambling, I've already hedged out, so it doesn't matter who wins it money-wise.
Right.
As a Toronto sports fan, I mean, you better not blow this, Raptors. You better not blow it. Thanks, Jeff.
Billy, I appreciate the call. And it really does seem it is all there. But again, I'm going to take this. I'll take the banged up Warriors narrative, as I said, with a grain of salt until I'm absolutely convinced that Klay Thompson isn't playing. If they have Klay Thompson and Steph Curry, they've got a shot. I still believe Kevin Durant is going to come back. And I would not be completely surprised if he comes back in game three. But I'm not underestimating the Golden State Warriors by any stretch of the imagination. I just think this series has been an accurate reflection of the way the two games have been played. I mean, it really has. It's been a pretty explicable two games. There's no great mystery, I don't think, to what's happened. No great mystery to what has to happen for both teams to be successful. But again, let's wait and see just how healthy or unhealthy Golden State is, because I'm when it comes to this team, I'm skeptical when I read the injury report. I really am. Robin Uxbridge says it's a missed opportunity when you miss as many shots as the Raptors did in the fourth. It's still only lost by 5 points. That's a definition of lost opportunity. Maybe. I think you can look at every game that way, though, as a lost opportunity. I think the problem with saying a game is a lost opportunity is you underestimate the abilities, the strength, and the character of the other team. I really do. And it's right if the Raptors make a few late baskets, obviously they win that game. But they didn't, and that happens in basketball. They're not the first team to have that happen to them. So, again, as I said, I respectfully disagree. I don't look at lost opportunities. I really don't. Because I think you can drive yourself nuts. You can drive yourself nuts doing that. Now, there's a difference, to Billy's point, there's a difference between having a debate on whether or not it's a lost opportunity and whether or not the series itself is a wasted chance. I think this is pretty clear that, and we'll know this more if Kevin Durant doesn't play in game three, this whole series is an opportunity for the Raptors, because this team, this Golden State Warriors team, is weaker than it's ever been during this championship run. And honest to God, if Klay Thompson is hobbled and if Kevin Durant doesn't come back for a couple of games, has there been another team as in the final, another finalist as beaten up as this Golden State Warriors team? I can't remember one. I mean, I'm sure there are teams that have injury issues, that have had injury issues in the finals. I don't know if anybody's been as beaten up as this team is, if all those injuries turn out as has been reported. 416-870-0590, star 591, 888-666-0590. 590-590 is the text line. We'll go back to the lines. It's a Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Bay Area sound list for the soundtrack for the next couple of days. Since the Raptors are in the Bay Area, Derek Brandeo and I had this argument about Oakland. They play in Oakland. You expand the Bay Area to San Francisco and Berkeley, you get a wider choice of music, obviously. Derek tried to argue against it, but I suggested, since he cheated and included Hamilton in the Toronto playlist the first time we hit it, we can at least do this. Yeah, I know you put it here because of it. So anyhow, any songs by Bay Area based bands, send along the suggestion on Twitter, SN Jeff Blair, use the hashtag Blair Show, or 590-590 is the text line, and we'll endeavor to get them on. And no, we're not going to play We Built This City, so don't worry about it. 416-870-0590, star 591, 888-666-0590. 590-590 is the text line. What a great postseason it would be for Kawhi Leonard, right? Kawhi Leonard wins the MVP award in the NBA playoffs. Raptors win the championship, and he wins the lawsuit against Nike. Well, I don't know if he's going to win his lawsuit against Nike. He certainly filed one, and over a trademark violation. Mark Edelman, who's the tenured law professor at the Zicklin School of Business, Baruch College, City University of New York, will join us at 10 o'clock to talk about Kawhi Leonard's lawsuit against Nike. He's got five lawyers. Five lawyers. That's Trumpian in number. Go back to the phone lines. Rob in Niagara Falls, what's up, Rob?
Long time no talk, Jeff. How are you?
I am doing well, thank you. Splendidly.
Good. Nice to hear. Go Bruins. I just had to get that in there. I would just like to see them try doing a couple of alley-oops if the three balls aren't working early. It looks like Andrea Bargnani days again when your seven-footer's shooting three balls for you. Get in there and cram the crate just a couple of times. We don't need 10 threes in the first half. Give me 15 twos. And the more you run the floor, if this team's as banged up as they are, our guys will be able to work it. And you can cycle through with Van Vliet, Powell, and Lowry, don't be afraid to put them down low to take a short shot.
Well, there's a couple of things that work here. First of all, if Golden State insists on playing Andrew Bogut and with DeMarcus Cousins, it's a different lineup. Secondly, with all due respect, you're not beating the Golden State Warriors shooting mid-range jump shots. You're not. You beat the Golden State Warriors by draining threes. If you get into a game where you're trading two for three, you're going to lose. I mean, you just are. So, yeah, I get your point, but you're not going to see the Raptors, I don't think, focus completely on that, nor should they.
No, I understand that, but I'm just saying, even as a different look, if you do it two or three times, they have to be able to defend against it, and it ops other options for you later.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. I'm not sure that's how Golden State's defense would work, to be honest. It's not that easy. Now, if Golden State decides that they are going to utilize their bigs more and play that type of game, then we can have that discussion. But I think we had, we were talking to Derek Smith yesterday, and the point is, if Golden State is going to start, you know, trying to lob the ball and do things of that, you are going to need a better game out of Marc Gasol and Serge Ibaka. You're going to need a better defensive game. I think the worst thing, I'll tell you, if we get into a janky game, I love that word. And according to the slang dictionary, it means unreliable. But if we get into a janky game, to borrow Steph Curry's words, I would be concerned about fouls. I think this is a game, game three, if we get into that type of game, we are going to need Serge Ibaka and Marc Gasol to play terrific defense. Game three, I will tell you right now, if Clay's hurt and if Golden State has a patchwork lineup out there, I guarantee you it is going to be a game with plenty of fouls. And if that's the case, you are absolutely, absolutely going to need Serge Ibaka and Marc Gasol at their best. Daniel in Toronto. What's up, man?
Good morning, Jeff. How are you? Nice to talk to you.
It's been a while. Yes, it has.
In the vein of what your last caller was talking about, the only thing that you could say or what he may be referring to that the Raptors can do more of is just drive and kick because, if they're not, the only way they'll get twos is if they go to the bucket, but those drives are going to be used to get open shooters on the perimeter. Mm-hmm. So I totally agree with you. And I also agree with you about the bigs. I was going to say, and I've said it the whole series, that I didn't really think until DeMarcus Cousins came back that the Golden State Warriors were that strong down low, that we should take advantage of our size, especially on offense, but as you saw in the last game on defense. And I think that the reason that we got a lot of cuts backdoor where we got caught watching them was because, if you notice, Nick Nurse plays a little bit of a zone. It's almost like a one with a box, which means there's two defenders at the top of the key and two down low. And whenever they go up to help on the perimeter shot, what happens is those defenders down low, they come up to the middle of the key, which leaves that back door open. That happened to them. They got burned on that three or four times. You know, I'm not going to harp on the third quarter because really that's the only quarter that killed us, and everybody knows that. That was the reason why the Raptors still were able to keep it close. And but just with regards to the injuries, Jeff, I want to know if you agree with me or not. You know, like the media, especially in the States, talks about these injuries. One day they say one thing, and the next day it's a complete opposite. And last night I was watching a broadcast on NBA TV Game Time in the States, and Jason Terry said that, oh, well, Kevin Durant's calf strain is an injury that could take 5 or 6 or 7 weeks, but I think he'll be back for Game 4. So I don't think there's any credence to what the reports are on the injuries. I just think that you just have to come out and play your game, no matter who your opponent is. And for me, the Raptors' game and their MO, like we've talked about all season long, has been their D, and their D has to sustain those third quarter runs.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't, when you get to the playoffs, I really don't pay a great deal of attention to injury reports, only because, I mean, we've seen so many times players overcome injuries or players have decent games when we suspected they were injured. I mean, even Steph Curry, you know, there are people in the first quarter of Sunday's game, you know, suggesting that Steph Curry might have to leave the game. Well, I mean, Steph Curry went into the locker room, came out and had a decent second half and was on the court down the stretch and ended up playing, you know, Steph Curry minutes. So you can't put a lot of stock in that. And also there are ways of disguising whether or not a player has an injury, you know, by how you use him, by how many minutes you give him, by when you call timeouts. There's all sorts of ways. There's all sorts of ways around it. Look, the Kevin Durant situation is complicated. And that's why I thought winning game two was important for Golden State, because it at least delays for a couple of days some uncomfortable questions, right? If Kevin Durant doesn't come back to play, Kevin Durant's going to go into his offseason as a free agent. People are going to be looking at Kevin Durant and going, well, wait a minute, you didn't play in the finals. Are you hurt? How hurt are you? Are you seriously enough hurt that you're not going to be of much use to us halfway through the year? Conversely, if you're Kevin Durant and you go out and play in the finals and you hurt yourself, well, now you've effectively screwed yourself as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of uncomfortable decisions that need to be, you know, or a lot of uncomfortable elements to the decision as to when Kevin Durant plays or doesn't play. Ultimately, it's going to come down to, are you healthy? Can you help us? And the beauty about basketball is, you know, it's not like you're losing another roster spot by putting Kevin Durant on there, right? You put Kevin Durant, you're not going to replace Kevin Durant. You put Kevin Durant on there and as a coach, utilize him to the point where you get something out of him, even if it's for a few minutes. You know, providing you're not going to seriously injure the guy for the rest of his career, even for a few minutes, you can get something out of Kevin Durant and you can have an impact on the game. So, yeah, I do take everything with a grain of salt when it comes to injuries, but I also think they may be less of a factor in basketball than in some other sports because I think you can get away with it. Tony and Maple, what's up, Tony?
Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Good, good.
Good. You know what? I'll summarize a little quickly here. If Durant wasn't a free agent, he'd probably be playing.
But yeah, I don't know. You know, I could see that. Yeah, I guess sure. Because right. What's he got? You know, what's he got to lose? And
right. He's going to get paid anyway, and whatever. So
yeah.
He can't risk his career and whatever. So that's why he's got obviously his agents and his own doctors that are going to give him the advice.
Right.
Alluding to, and I respectfully disagree with you that the Raptors have to go for the 3-point baskets. You're not going to beat Golden State by you trying to make more threes than them. We know that's their strength. This is the legendary club of the threes. So what I think the Raptors need to do is, obviously, you need to make some threes, but the volume has to be more the 2 points. And, Jeff, I think this is why the benefit would be this. If you rush the basket, Curry's guarding somebody. Thompson's guarding somebody. Those are the guys that need to be going to the basket. Put those players in foul trouble. When you do that, you're going to minimize their effectiveness when they're on offense as well. And to this point, nobody's done that. I think it's another strategic move that Nurse should consider.
Can I ask you something? Why do you think nobody's done that?
Why they haven't done it?
Yeah.
Sometimes they think that it can't be done against these guys. So why not try it? If it hasn't been done, how do you know you won't succeed?
I would argue that your chances more often than not of going head-to-head with Steph Curry and getting right. the benefit of the referee's whistle is right. really minimal.
Well,
And the Raptors did. The Raptors were physical with Steph Curry in game
right.
one. And they have the perfect defender. Fred VanVleet can get in his chest.
Right.
But I know people say that, but to me, I don't want to put myself in a position. I don't want to put myself in a position, Tony, where I can let the referees take over the game. And I think if you focus too much on that.
But Jeff, you know what? So if Thompson is guarding Leonard, the referee, if you're going to say that, okay, they're skewed in favor of the
superstar. I'm thinking more in terms of Curry.
Okay. But we got to take the whole package here. I'm saying the two guys that are going to annihilate the Raptors, if they're going to, is going to be Thompson and Curry. So go at those two guys. So if you match up Curry with, if you match up Leonard with Thompson, and if Thompson's guarding Leonard, I don't think the ref is going to have a bias because they're both superstars here. Mm. They're going to have to be fair. And if you put a guy like Lowry versus Curry, the same thing goes here. Now, obviously, yeah, you're going to give the benefit of the call to Curry, but it's not an overstretch to say that Kyle deserves the same respect as Curry.
He sure didn't get it in game two. I'll tell you what. When it comes to respect from the referee, Kyle versus Curry, Curry's winning that 99% of the time.
Okay, and Leonard versus Thompson? But like I said,
we're going around and around in this. I get your point in that you can go at these guys. I get that. You know, but I also respectfully disagree. I think you've got to hit a good volume of threes to beat Golden State. I just don't think you can rely on 2-pointers. Now, I mean, you can get into discussion of where you get those jumpers from and how you get those 2-pointers if you're doing that right. and going to the line. Which, you know, again, once you get past Curry and Thompson, You know, you're dealing with Iguodala and Draymond Green, and they're as capable as anybody of making a, you know, of committing a foul. Now I'll buy that, because not only are you getting the two, you're getting the free throw, and you're getting a chance to set your defense up.
Right.
So I will grant you that. We got to scoot, Tony. Appreciate the call. Kawhi Leonard, as I mentioned, not only is he in the NBA Finals, not only has he been the best player in the NBA, he's got a lawsuit against Nike involving the claw logo that he designed and that he says Nike has co-opted. We'll talk to Mark Edelman, tenured law professor at the City University of New York, when the Jeff Blair Show continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Now Jeff Blair can tell you bedtime stories. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher and listen anytime you want. Sweet dreams. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. He figured you could use some lucid, logical, coherent perspective in your life. You know, since your opinion's usually so way off. This is The Jeff Blair Show on Toronto Sports Radio. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Stop what you're doing, cause I'm about to ruin the image and the style that you're used to. I look funny, but yo, I'm making money, see? So yo, world, I hope you're ready for me. Now gather round. I'm the new fool in town, and my sound's laid down.
All right, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show.
Drink a bottle of Hennessy you got on your shelf.
So a couple of things to deal with here. Myself. My name is Humpty. Matt and Thunder Bay on text. Disagree with Durant playing if he's under contract. He's getting a max contract regardless. I think it's a ploy to keep the Raps from fully committing to no Durant. Raps still have to game plan for Durant even at this moment. Fair point. Playing mind games, that's certainly in keeping with playoff tradition. And got to deal with this. This is from Tom and Vaughn, who I love and is a frequent texter. This got my goat a little bit, though. What's with Toronto fans? If I could afford a Raps playoff ticket, I wouldn't lose a second of the game and cheer my lungs out. In Game 2, thousands of fans were still busy eating, drinking, and chatting while the second half started and the away team went in an 18-0 run. Raps will take Game 1 in Oakland. I'm still confident in a Norris victory. This is our destiny year, Tom and Vaughn. Okay, we got to talk about this because one of the American talking heads, I don't know, was it Stephen A. Smith? Somebody like that. We're talking about the fact that the seats were empty at the start of the second half. They're always empty at the start of the second half. The people who have those seats have a ton of money, and they spend a lot of time eating and chatting and networking. That's Toronto. You will hear people say that, you know, well, there's always a lineup for the washrooms, et cetera, et cetera. Well, my argument to that is hold it in. We all do it. But beyond that, yeah, with all due respect, any of you seen a game in Houston? Have you seen the stands at Houston at the half when the second half starts? They're empty. Madison Square Garden, largely empty. The lower bowls of a lot of arenas, especially the newer ones, are quite often empty because that's where the suites are. And once the game starts, you're not, you know, the ushers, you're not going to be allowed back in until there's a stoppage in play. That's just the way it works. So I'm sorry. I'm not having the lack of fans in the seats thing. Didn't appear to bother the Raptors in game one. Now, I didn't do a count, but I'm willing to bet that the empty seats in game one were roughly the same as the empty seats in game two. It certainly hasn't bothered the Raptors for most of their home games where they've done reasonably well. So it's a non-starter. Period. If you are focusing on that while you're at an event like the NBA Finals, it doesn't say much for your engagement, shall we say. So Kawhi Leonard, in addition to, as we said, being the best player in the NBA playoffs, I think we can safely say that so far he has, has filed a lawsuit against Nike. Of course, a multinational corporation. He is suing Nike over their use of his personal logo. And, you know, the whole world of athletes and personal logos and sneaker sponsorship and all that stuff, it, to me, has always been kind of an unnecessarily complicated issue. But essentially, on Monday, he filed a lawsuit against Nike over a personal logo that he says Nike has fraudulently copywritten. This is a logo that he designed a few years ago, and it's based on his, you know, the large hand that he has, right? And there's stylized versions of the initials KL and the number 2, you know, numbers he'd worn for most of the year. And according to Leonard's lawyers, these are drawings that he'd been creating early in his college career. And as part of an endorsement deal with Nike, Leonard allowed Nike to use the logo on certain merchandise while Leonard continued to use the logo on non-Nike goods. So in other words, it was, you can use it, I can use it. The lawsuit contends that unbeknownst to Leonard and without his consent, Nike filed an application for copyright registration of his logo and falsely represented in the application that Nike had authored the logo. Now, you know that Kawhi is now a New Balance guy. His Nike contract expired, I think, in the summer, in September. And Kawhi Leonard wants to use this logo on, you know, any future clothing lines, footwear, and other products, you know, sports camps and charity functions. And apparently Nike has explicitly objected to such uses. Now, this is no frivolous lawsuit. And while you don't necessarily base the seriousness of a lawsuit on the number of lawyers you have, Kawhi Leonard's got 5 lawyers arguing this case for him. So clearly Kawhi Leonard isn't doing this for yucks, you know, to pass his time away while he tries to figure out where the hell he's playing next year. Mark Edelman is tenured law professor, Zicklin School of Business, Baruch College, City University of New York. And Mark Edelman joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a long time. We appreciate you coming on. So explain this lawsuit to me. I mean, from a distance, it would seem pretty clear cut. But on the other hand, I've got to think, you know, Nike's a big company and a smart company, and I've got to think that they must, I mean, I don't think they would do this just for, you know, just to pass the time away either, would they?
Well, the big question that we don't know is we've seen the lawsuit and we've read the complaint. The complaint is a document which is filed by Kawhi Leonard's attorneys, arguing that Nike is infringing upon their mark. And also arguing that Nike took something that was created by Leonard and tried to pin it off a copyright on his own. And if you read the about 12-page complaint that was written by Kawhi Leonard's attorneys, and you accept all of those facts as true, this looks like an easy slam dunk for Leonard. But all we have right now is the arguments from the standpoint of Leonard's attorneys. And in a 30-day period, Nike will have the opportunity to file something known as the answer, which simplified will be Nike's version of the story. The big piece of information that we don't have, and we won't have it now, and we won't have it in 30 days either, is what was the language contained in this 2011 agreement between Nike and Leonard? If we accept the basis of these facts as true, there was a drawing that we have to presume Leonard created. And there was some agreement between Leonard and Nike that gave Nike certain rights to use that drawing, at least in conjunction with this agreement. Mm. But we have no idea, based on anything written in the complaint filed by Leonard's attorneys, what is specifically stated in the agreement between the two, and whether that would give Nike any continuing rights to this logo, or whether Nike simply just infringed in both copyright and trademarks.
Why would I, you know, I'll ask a very basic question. Why would Nike do this? I mean, it seemed, you know, the relationship, again, he's moved on to new brand, and you're right, we, you know, we need to hear Nike's argument here. But it seems to me as if, you know, an agreement that was in place for that long, and, I, you know, again, we don't know this, but at this juncture, it doesn't appear as if there are a lot of flashpoints surrounding the logo up until now. Why would Nike do this? I mean, it wouldn't be just petulance on the part of the company because Leonard went to New Balance, would it?
Well, first, we do not know what's in the agreement, and that's important. I have to cast aside, and we have two different conversations here. The issue of the public relations of what Nike has done and the legal issue. As far as the legal issue, we have to reserve some judgment until we see what's in the agreement between Leonard and Nike. And perhaps Leonard's attorneys gave greater rights to Nike than Leonard knows or Leonard's attorneys care to admit. Back in 2011. Mind you, at that time, Leonard was a rookie in the league, and he was not a top three or four draft pick, and Nike might have been able to obtain very broad rights to work that Leonard made. But leaving that aside, you make a great point, Jeff. From the public relations perspective, no matter what comes out in this legal case, this is a loss for Nike. And Nike does have a reputation of being a bully company in other ways as well. I mean, if you look with respect to track athletes and with respect to the Olympics and different areas in terms of making people cover up logos, Nike has been very aggressive, and Nike has been willing to bully smaller athletes at many points in time. So it's certainly possible that Nike gained these rights from Leonard. We don't know that yet. But leaving aside now the legal perspective, as a matter of PR, this is a loss for Nike either way.
From a distance, it would seem almost that the end game here would be, and again, as I will say, keeping in mind we have not seen Nike's filing, but it almost seems as if the end game here would be to force a negotiated agreement, would it not?
I think that's completely correct. 90% of all cases that file ultimately settle before final adjudication. My view is this is one which is going to be on the far greater than 90% side. Perhaps there'll be some share of certain revenues that Nike might be able to maintain or vice versa. While this would be a fascinating one as a law professor to have a final court opinion on that I could teach in a class, I don't think we will get one. And from the standpoint of Nike, it will be in their interest to settle this. Because if any of the facts alleged by Leonard are true, even if they don't state a winnable claim, Nike does not come off looking very good.
Is there a cautionary tale here for young athletes, you know, for athletes who maybe, you know, now where Kawhi Leonard was back then? Is there a cautionary tale here? Again, you're right. It almost seems as if it was sort of Nike thinking they were doing Kawhi a solid and Kawhi sort of, you know, returning the favor almost. Is there, I don't know if there's a cautionary tale here.
I mean, there certainly is. And again, we don't know what's in the agreement. So it is certainly possible that everything that Kawhi Leonard says was in the initial agreement was true. And Nike is just being the big bully. It is also very possible that Nike has certain greater rights than even Leonard understands.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, the minute that an athlete turns pro, or hopefully if we do get some reform to the NCAA at an even earlier period of time, these athletes will have the opportunity to sell use of their names and likenesses and perhaps in certain cases sell certain creations that they've made and give up intellectual property rights. And they will have to choose who they want to represent them, not only in terms of their agents, but in terms of the lawyers on this deal. My gut is back in 2011, Leonard probably did not read the entirety of the agreement that he signed with Leonard, I mean, with Nike. And that's not a knock on Leonard. I mean, at that point in time, His first focus is going to be getting ready for his rookie basketball season. And you choose people to handle the legal work on your behalf. For Leonard's case, I think we just need to hope that the lawyer who signed off on this agreement did not just cave to a big company in Nike and actually made sure to protect the rights of the athlete he was representing. And again, we don't know. Maybe that lawyer for Leonard did do a terrific job. We won't know until we see that 2011 contract.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Really appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure.
Mark Edelman is tenured law professor at the Zicklin School of Business, Baruch College, City University of New York. Again, Kawhi Leonard filing a lawsuit against Nike. Kawhi Leonard was a Nike athlete from 2011 to 2018. He's now with New Balance. Of course, New Balance put up those King of the North billboards that in Oakland. Kawhi Leonard had designed a logo. It's referred to the emails that were made public between the company and Kawhi Leonard. It was referred to as Kawhi's logo. A logo that he allowed Nike to use, and Nike allowed him to use as well. There was really no restriction on the use of the logo. Unbeknownst to Kawhi Leonard, at least according to his lawyers, Nike filed an application with the U.S. Copyright Office to copyright that logo, and that would mean that Kawhi Leonard couldn't use the logo on any of his own brand apparel or any charitable things. I mean, Nike would have full use of the logo. And so in response, Kawhi Leonard filed this lawsuit. And I think as you heard Mark and I talk, you know where this is going to end up. Ultimately, there will be a negotiated agreement between the two parties. And I'm sure as part of that, Kawhi will receive some rights insofar as the use of the logo. But again, until we see what Nike's counterfiling is, we don't know the full. We wouldn't be able to put the discussion in the full legal context, but it's certainly it's certainly interesting, and gets to the whole question of athletes and their brand, which is going forward going to be and is a huge issue for athletes. The brand is where you make a lot of your ancillary income, right? And as someone pointed out to me, it's a lot easier to hide your money, the money you get out of stuff like that, compared to your salary. Your salary is a matter of record. The money you kind of earn away from the actual playing of the game, there are various ways. That's the way the rich operate, right? There are various ways to ensure that your money is protected and kept away from the clutches of the government. So, significant issue for Kawhi Leonard. Again, a reminder, the NBA Finals Game 3 is tomorrow on Sportsnet Ontario. Tip-off is at 9 o'clock. And another reminder that we want to send you to Game 5. Got some lower bowl tickets for you. You've got to listen all day for the keywords we're giving out and text us for your chance at lower bowl tickets to Game 5 of the Finals. This is your shot at seeing the Raptors in their first ever NBA Finals against the Golden State Warriors. The contest is brought to you in part by Tangerine, official bank of the Toronto Raptors and their fans. Go to sportsnet.ca/590 for full details. The Stanley Cup final is tied up at 2 games apiece. The St. Louis Blues taking care of that with a 4-2 win over the Boston Bruins last night. Game 5, the series shifts back to Boston Thursday on CBC and Sportsnet Ontario. Hockey Central's pregame at 7:30. Puck drop will be just after 8. Gord Stellick is host of our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. He's also, of course, host of Hockey Central, and Gord Stellick will join us when the Jeff Blair Show continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Because hockey hasn't completely taken over your life yet. Subscribe to podcasts of Hockey Central at Noon through iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
For you, play the record once a day or as needed.
Bruce, on the this maybe relates back to having 5D, but on the winning goal, O'Reilly's second goal, was that just a slow change, maybe a little confusion, and is it a result of you know, a little bit of a scramble for because you're missing a guy.
We were late a little bit. Got inside position, O'Reilly. Once they get inside position, they're a big team. You're up against it. Tough shot for Tuca. Kind of handcuffed him. It's Pietrangelo. He can really bring it. They worked hard to get inside. And if you work hard to get in there enough, the puck finds it. You know, you get some breaks. You can score some goals. And they did that. They did that better than we did tonight. But, yeah, we got caught there a little bit, unfortunately. And, you know, obviously with Z out, we got to do a, you know, the onus becomes on us more as a staff, the coaches. They're young. You got Clifton, you got McAvoy, you got Carl. These kids are young. Torrey's been around, but and Johnny Moore, but they're not old, you know, grizzled veterans. So we have to coach them up, all right? So that's our challenge going into game five. We've got to do a better job with them as a staff.
That is Bruce Cassidy, the head coach of the Boston Bruins, speaking after yesterday's 4-2 or last night's 4-2 loss to the St. Louis Blues. The Stanley Cup best of seven series is tied at 2 games apiece. Game five goes Thursday on CBC and Sportsnet Ontario. Puck drop is just after 8 o'clock. And this is going to be the 10th time in the last 12 years that the final is going to require at least 6 games. And it's the 26th time the final's been tied at 2-2 after 4 games. And the team that has won game four to tie the series has gone on to win the cup 10 of the previous 25 times, including 3 of the last 5 occasions. All of which, means nothing. Gord Stellick is host of our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And Gord Stellick joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Hello, Mr. Stellick. Long time no speak, sort of.
Well, I know, Mr. Blair. We still chat despite Raptor fever and everything else. So nice to join you this morning.
So Zdeno Chara takes a puck in the mouth, returns wearing a full mask, the shield and the kind of the bird cagey little thing on the bottom of it, sits at the end of the bench and doesn't play. You know, and it's great. It gives everybody something to write about and ask Bruce Cassidy about in the next couple of days in the lead up to Wednesday's game. I'm sure Zdeno Chara, being Zdeno Chara, is probably going to play 130 minutes on Thursday, because that's the way he is. But let's just say there's a slight chance that he doesn't. Bruce Cassidy, I thought, made it pretty clear. I mean, he wasn't blaming his young defenseman, but clearly you lose a guy like Chara, there is going to be a pretty significant trickle-down effect on your defense corps. How much of an issue will this be for the Bruins going forward? Because it's been, for the most part, pretty smooth sailing for this team so far in the postseason.
I think, you know, really significant, Jeff. I know Toronto Maple Leaf fans who've seen Boston 3 times in playoffs, in the last 8 years, the intangibles and the realities Zdeno Chara brings. And, you know, keep in mind, Matt Grzelcyk didn't make the trip to St. Louis. I don't think he'll be back. They've been out without Kevin Miller for a while. So you're talking about 3D out of the lineup. And I don't know what to make about Chara coming back to the bench, because it seemed like he wanted to do that inspirational factor. But then post-game, you know, with what you saw, it didn't seem like a little blemish. I mean, Vince Dunn returned for St. Louis after elements of a broken jaw and missed 6 games. And that's like on the light side, right? If anything close like that is the case for Zdeno Chara. But there's a lot of pessimism about his ability to play in a couple of days. But as you mentioned, if he did, maybe if he's back, who knows? He'll play 30 minutes. But that is a huge question mark heading into game number 5.
So how does Boston overcome that? Well, how do they... You know, I mean, I guess the easiest thing to do when you have a big piece missing, and I do mean that figuratively and literally, is you just say, well, look, we can't replace Zdeno Chara, so you just kind of leave everything as it is and try to make do with what you have there. But that's considering how important a role he plays on that team, and considering that, as Bruce Cassidy said, it is a relatively young defense corps. How do you see them going about handling this?
Well, the one thing in the playoffs, you can get by playing your stud D a ton. We saw the Chicago Blackhawks, you know, basically have 3.5 defensemen a couple of years ago, right, and win a Stanley Cup. And in Charlie McAvoy, it looks like you got the real deal. Torrey Krug, I mean, this guy now, Jeff, is kind of like Morgan Rielly and Giordano, Mark Giordano this past year. you know, creeping into Norris Trophy consideration. And that's really Torrey Krugus just incredibly impressed people that way. You know, Campney's played well when he's had to come in. You got a guy in, you know, in Miller that you signed from the New Jersey Devils about, you know, his ability to play and others like that. So really your big studs have to be, your big studs would be the key that way, I would think, for the Boston Bruins. Because no question, depth-wise, particularly with the return of Dunn on the decor for the St. Louis Blues, they got the edge in that. Of course, I was talking about more for the Boston Bruins right. earlier as far as a depth D that they acquired from New Jersey.
What was the difference in that game last night?
Every time St. Louis has responded, and, you know, we've chatted about it, the Dallas series was phenomenal that way about kind of this chess match. And every time you've needed a response from the St. Louis Blues, like I thought they were more dominant in the Winnipeg series, but ever since then, they have given that kind of response, and so has Jordan Binnington. And they went out, and they out-hit him, they outplayed him, they outshot him. They did everything. A little bit of juggling that Craig Berube's done. The logical guy, you thought he might sit out Zach Sanford. Instead, he put him on he put him on a line that ended up being a top line in a lot of ways as far as, you know, it went moving some guys around. Ryan O'Reilly playing with him and Perron. So he really did some juggling that kind of, you know, got away from the old fourth line and made their first two lines a little bit able to function, a little bit more balanced that way. So I've liked all those elements that they did the St. Louis Blues. I mean, it's not smash mouth, but they play a physical style. When Boston tied at 1-1, and again, Chera made a nice play on that, the goal by Charlie Coyle, St. Louis again responded. And then, of all things, a shorthanded goal ties at 2-2 for the Bruins, and usually that's a momentum changer. And once again, St. Louis responded. So I've been very impressed by the Blues, and there's no question the momentum has swung the Blues' way, even though Boston has home ice advantage. But with the question marks about Chara now, that puts a lot of things in doubt.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting that the game-winning goal would come, you know, 2 minutes after St. Louis had killed off a penalty to Jane Bouwmeester, considering how much of an impact the Bruins special teams have had in this series, and that was the play that Bruce Cassidy was referring to, where Alex Pietrangelo saw that the Bruins were a little slow in the line change, and he takes a shot at Tuukka Rask. The rebound goes into the slot, and Ryan O'Reilly knocks it in. Ryan O'Reilly having a terrific game, and really a guy. Look, people around the league have known about him, but he's a guy who's really stepped to the forefront this postseason for the Blues, hasn't he?
Yeah, no question. And you look at the Blues team. You mentioned Jay Bouwmeester, so you've got a guy in Jay Bouwmeester who, you know, after Joe Thornton, he's probably the next level of guy not to have playoff success or a Stanley Cup ring. I think you would have known Alex Steen's dad, Thomas, in Winnipeg. I mean, there's another, you know, veteran guy there. Then you throw in the Jordan Binnington about the kid that way. And then Ryan O'Reilly, and, you know, chatting with Mike Harrington in Buffalo, he was saying he caught up to O'Reilly early in the season or midway when the Blues weren't playing well. And to be frank, O'Reilly was baffled, kind of like, how come teams suck everywhere I go? Is there an element that he was wearing it in some people's eyes, like Colorado wasn't a good situation when he left. Certainly Buffalo wasn't. And now St. Louis hadn't been the first part of the season. And yet everyone would say, geez, Ryan O'Reilly is a great player. I mean, Ryan O'Reilly is a guy you'd love to have on your team. But even he was starting to have some of those doubts because that's all he knew. So it's nice to see when the pressure's off and that, him being able to thrive in that kind of environment. I know Chris Johnston wrote about it in Sportsnet.ca, and our buddy Mark Savard is huge on both the sticks and your taping twigs and how they're all different. So I guess he's worked on his. It's a unique sculpture Ryan O'Reilly has, and he put it to good use last night. He's been putting it to good use in the playoffs.
So we mentioned special teams have been an integral part of Boston's success. No Zdeno Chara. How do they go about handling the situation on special teams? Never mind balancing the minutes their defensemen are going to need. How do you go about handling those situations on special teams?
You mean for the Bruins?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to miss him. There's no doubt about it. He's a big part of the power play that way and you know, eats up PK. So that's the part they're going to miss. I love their PP in the sense, and we saw it when they played the Leafs, it seems like everybody's interchangeable. They just keep moving around, you know, all just keep moving around and they can take shots from many different points. Like, they're not as static as, say, the Leafs power play was, when you kind of wondered, can you flip Matthews and Marner a bit and, you know, try a few things different. So, you know, that's going to be a challenge. And I don't care who you put in, that's going to be a challenge. But this is where, Jeff, the guys, the fact they have so many guys wearing Stanley Cup rings compared to the St. Louis Blues, how does that come into play and finding a way to overcome that in the final three games? I mean, that's where you're going to need to get more out of those other guys on it. And meanwhile, like I said, you can, and McAvoy and Krug, you have two pretty good studs on D to be deployed as much as possible.
Gordon, I want to shift focus a little bit to the local the local squad here. Much talk, much discussion about a deal involving, or a deal for Nikita Zaitsev and Patrick Marleau. You know, two separate deals, obviously, but clearly, you know, Zaitsev requesting a trade, and Marleau essentially a salary cap dump. How do you see Kyle Dubas going about pulling this off? Because I think a lot of people's fear is that to get somebody to take Patrick Marleau's salary, you are going to have to eat a substantial amount, but you're also going to have to throw a player in there as a sweetener, and it could very well be somebody off the active roster. Where do you see this going?
Well, I would think it'd be more likely a draft pick, but I could see it heading that way. And, you know, two different elements. One was Zaitsev. He came to Toronto by choice. So, and he played his best year the year before he got that 7-year contract, which has been kind of perplexing. So a right shot defenseman, 5 years left. You got to hope there's a team or two that might take it just as a standalone type trade. You can't expect anything significant back. I would worry or be leery about picking up coin in that matter. Patrick Marleau's a different matter. And to be fair, because Kyle Dubas, you know, last summer, if he had a mulligan, he would redo his contract negotiation process over. You know, this is one that Lou Lamoriello left, and it was always going to be problematic this upcoming year. That's the whole reason they got Patrick Marleau. Never in their wildest dreams do I think they expected John Tavares to land a year later. So, you know, that salary is added to the predicament. So this one's going to it's interesting because the teams that he seems to want to play, they're stuck on the cap. So do you bring an Arizona in, for example, that, you know, takes some cap space and help you out that way, and then flip it to whatever team, whether it's San Jose or be reunited with Todd McClellan, this time with the Los Angeles Kings, at an attractive number for them. And in that case, the Leafs are going to have to throw a draft pick or something in that way and possibly eat maybe a little bit of the salary. But the, I say, relative upside is Patrick Marleau could just say he's got a no-trade contract and no-buyout contract. He could have said, I'm just going to stay here. I want the money. I want the six, and you're going to take the 6.5 hit. So I'm kind of glad it's worked out that way, because I think we saw in the playoffs, like, and you know, it wasn't the same contribution the second season. And to be honest, I'd rather Mike Babcock not have the choice to have him out there and say, instead of Austin Matthews or others, playing so many minutes in the playoffs.
So how much do you think, again, we don't know until the deals actually happen, but how much money do you think at the end of the day the Leafs can save with these two deals that, you know, have to spend on players?
Well, you know, best case scenario, the entire 4.5 from there's a buyer out there, and you save that from Zaitsev. I'm giving best case scenario. In Marleau's case, you know, now cash wise, they're paying a $4 million. They're paying the cash July 1st. The Leafs will pay that bonus. So actual cash would be about 1.25, but I'd say on the cap hit, can it be a $5 million save? Do they have to eat $1.25 or something like that? I mean, so theoretically, we're talking about $9 million. But also, without Zaitsev, Jeff, there's no defenseman. I don't care whether you don't like Zaitsev, you don't like Jake Gardner or whatever. So now you've got Zaitsev, Hainsey, Jake Gardner not coming back. So, you know, you need to get some bodies, and hopefully decent bodies on the D, because, you know, whatever Mitch Marner's going to make and others and what have you, man, oh, man, right now the way the D is set up depth-wise, you got big problems if you want to get to the Stanley Cup final where Boston and St. Louis are right now.
Yeah, and, I mean, you know, and we've heard, everything we've heard is that you could probably get Sandin into the NHL next year, but you know, there are people who tell you that Timothy Liljegren is not yet ready. So it's not a simple matter of bringing up your two guys from the Marlies and plugging them in.
And I think, you know, Callie Rosen's the guy that you think will be, you know, ready that way. And where, Jeff, they've been in a good place where guys have had to earn their way up. You don't want to go back to when you're kind of giving guys spot because you have no choice. But you almost need a Zach Hyman-type guy to emerge on D. You know, right. The way he did, come up and just be such a great fit up front. You almost have to hope that one of those Marley guys are. And then is there, you know, a serviceable Ron Hainsey type that they've done well the last couple of years with Matt Hunwick and then Hainsey, you know, plugging the holes a little bit that way.
Gord, it was great of you to join us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Gord Stellick, host of our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and also Hockey Central. And again, Game 5 of the Stanley Cup Finals goes Thursday on CBC and Sportsnet Ontario. That series is tied 2 games apiece. The Blues and the Bruins. A note that this morning, apparently, Bruce Cassidy, the head coach of the Bruins, has suggested that he may go with 7 defensemen and 11 forwards if Chara is not available to play. So the Bruins dealing with that and an injury to another defenseman as well. It'll be fascinating to see this team, the Bruins, without Zdeno Chara, because we're so used to him being part of the furniture. But that whole scenario last night was interesting. Coming back and sitting on the bench and not playing, I wonder if there was any concussion protocol followed as well. I mean, a shot in the mouth is clearly capable of giving you a concussion. It was an odd situation, whether it was to sort of, you know, a bit of a decoy, give Craig Berube, the Blues head coach, something to worry about. It was strange to see Zdeno Chara back on the bench. And again, we'll see how many games he has to miss, if he misses any games. But he is so integral to what this Bruins team has done, not just 5-on-5, but on special teams. And that's still, I think, at the end of the day, where the Bruins are going to hang their hat in this series, is on their ability in special teams. And so no Zdeno Chara certainly puts a major kink into the plans there for the Boston Bruins. But, I mean, we've also seen the Bruins are capable of, have shown that they're capable of weathering storms in the past. And Gord's absolutely right. Charlie McAvoy and Torrey Krug, they have, you know, they've got two defensemen they can rely on. You could probably ratchet McAvoy's minutes up, I guess. But typically the thinking is when a big player goes down, you don't blow everything up. You plug and play, plug in somebody else into that position and go with, go with the rest of what you have. The Toronto Blue Jays picked 11th in the Major League Baseball draft last night. They picked a right-handed pitcher out of West Virginia, Alek Manoah. Massive. Just taking a look at this guy it looks like Rowdy Tellez. He's a big right-handed pitcher, college pitcher. And if you look at his profile, there's not a lot of college pitchers who were taken in the first round that size who really turn into anything. I mean, my first thought was Deck McGuire, you know, a failed draft pick of the Blue Jays. But, you know, we know this management group, Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro, they've had successes, as everybody pointed out, with another fairly hefty pitcher, CC Sabathia, who is still pitching. No surprise, I don't think, that the Blue Jays took a pitcher. They were, in fact, the first team to take a pitcher in the draft. That was strange. A lot of position players went in the draft. Blue Jays essentially had the entire pool of pitching to select from. They also picked a pitcher with another pick a high school pitcher, Kendall Williams, from the IMG Academy in Bradenton. So, and probably no surprise when you look at the Blue Jays as an organization, there is a crying need right now for pitching depth. And there's really not a lot of elite high-end pitching depth in this organization. So, again, the Blue Jays picked Alek Manoah of West Virginia, 11th overall in the MLB draft. The Blue Jays will start a three-game series against the New York Yankees tonight at the Rogers Center. Masahiro Tanaka will start for the Yankees, Clayton Richard for the Jays. First pitch is at 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet Ontario. Blue Jays Central at 6:30. Ben Nicholson-Smith is co-host of our At the Letters podcast. He is the baseball editor at Sportsnet.ca, and Ben Nicholson-Smith joins us. It's the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
It's the only time you have control of Bob McCowan. Let's go! Subscribe to Primetime Sports Podcasts at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. His snark is worse than his bite. This is the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Probably let her play on and on. No, I'm sure other hosts have done. This song really should have been twice as long. I get that the shortness is part of it, of its strength. But it should be twice as long. This is some of the best lyrics. Probably Orange Barrel or Purple Microdome. Anyhow, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We've done it. We've let this song play to the end. The Toronto Blue Jays selected a right-handed pitcher, 11th in the Major League Baseball draft last night, Alek Manoah from West Virginia. Hard by Kevin Barker's home. I know it's a different state, but anyhow, it's close enough. This is the other side of the mountain, as John Gibbons would call it. That's the good news. The bad news is the Jays play the New York Yankees in the first of a three-game series. I shouldn't say that. The Jays play the New York Yankees in the first of a three-game series starting tonight at the Rogers Center. I have no idea yet if the roof's going to be open or not. I did see some gentlemen up on the roof this morning when I drove by it, but I also saw it open a little crack last week. So we shall see. It may not be a matter anyhow if the weather takes a turn for the worst. The Jays coming off an awful month of May, an awful road trip. Pitching is threadbare. The offense is practically non-existent. Other than that, things are looking up. Ben Nicholson-Smith is baseball editor at Sportsnet.ca. He's co-host over at the Letters podcast, and he joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. All right, I've got two doors here, Ben. I got door number one, the draft. I got door number two, the Jays. Which door do you want to walk through first, my friend? The decision is yours.
Wow, this is kind of fun. I get to choose the direction of the questions. Let's go draft, because that just happened more recently, and it can spare us from the struggles of the Toronto Blue Jays for at least a couple minutes.
You're a coward. You should have gone with the Blue Jays. Anyhow, that's fine. So I looked at Alek Manoah, and I think Keith Law pointed out that the Jays only need one more, and they've got the makings, one more guy that size, and they put him alongside Vladdy. They've got the makings of a pretty good offensive line. This dude is huge. This dude scares me because every time I see huge pitchers, I think Deck McGuire.
Yeah, it's definitely a different body type when you're looking at someone who's listed at 6'6", 260 pounds, and I obviously don't know the specifics, but it wouldn't be a surprise if in real life he clocked in at a little more than 260, a very, very big human being. And it works for Manoah. If you look at Virginia, to have 144 strikeouts and basically 100 innings pitched, I mean, he's had a really, really strong junior year there after impressing last summer in the Cape Cod League. So the Jays really like what they see. I mean, it's definitely an unconventional body type, but you know, you look at Marcus Stroman on this staff, and you look at CC Sabathia coming into town with the Yankees this week, and you know, certainly there are different body types out there for starting pitchers, and Manoah's got one, and the Jays believe that it can play in a major league rotation.
How quickly can we expand? I know that's a horribly unfair question, but I mean that's what a lot of people want to know. And there are college pitchers who've moved pretty rapidly through an organization. There are others who've sort of had stutter steps. But what is the thinking about this kid and how quickly he can move up?
Well, you know, if you look at the success that he's had, if you look at his frame, you know, you're not talking about a projectable guy in the same way that you would be with the Blue Jays second round pick, who's, you know, another 6'6 pitcher, but Kendall Williams is listed at 200 pounds. So he's more of that projectable frame. In the case of Manoah, you're looking at someone who's more closer to what he would be physically in the major league. So in that sense, you're not putting a ton of projection on him physically, but there's still the question of making your way through the minor leagues. And you know, I wouldn't think that he would be in the majors next year. So maybe Manoah is 2021 if everything goes well. But even, you know, you look at the current Blue Jays roster as a reminder of how long it takes for these players to make the major leagues a lot of the time. And even the guys who have been really quick, you know, college players who reach the major leagues quickly, like a Kevin Biggio, he was drafted 3 years ago, or Trent Thornton was drafted 4 years ago. And those are guys who are rookies right now and really had pretty quick paths through the minor leagues. So, you know, I don't know that 2021 is even a guarantee. Maybe you're looking at 2022 for Manoah.
What can you tell me about the next pick? I mean, I saw him, Kendall Williams. I've seen him talked about a great deal in Baseball America, for example.
Yeah, another right-handed pitcher, another 6'6 guy. He was committed to Vanderbilt, still is committed to Vanderbilt. And that gives him.
And we know that this organization, I mean, they like Vanderbilt, don't they? I mean, the pitching coaches, the people around Vanderbilt. I mean, that's a college that Ross Atkins talks about quite favorably. Even though this kid isn't there yet, he's just committed. I can see where there would be some sort of mutual interest there.
100%. Yeah, that's a college that, you know, certainly on the pitching side has some really impressive results, and the Blue Jays have taken note. So it isn't a surprise to see them connected to a Vanderbilt commit. But with Williams, the report on Baseball America is he's got five pitches he mixes in, fastball, slider, curve, change, and then a two-seamer. So that's a nice combination of pitches for a guy who's still 18 years old. And even if none of his offerings are completely overwhelming at this point, there's a sense when you're talking about kind of that skinny 6'6" kid that maybe he fills out a bit. You get a bit more, velocity even. But in the meantime, he's at least got the athleticism to repeat his delivery and mix in five pitches.
So Where do you think the Jays will continue to go as this draft goes on? Can you see them continuing to focus on pitching as they go along?
You know, usually by the time a draft ends, you know, I think we'll end up seeing basically 20 pitchers taken, 20 position players, and of the position players, you'd probably see four or five catchers, a bunch of center fielders, and a bunch of shortstops, really. I mean, I don't think that we're going to see too much variation from that general pattern this year. I think it will be half pitchers and half position players. And as for, you know, what happens round three versus round seven, I think a lot of that comes down to the way that they play with their bonus money, because as you know, Jeff, I mean, there's just so much maneuvering there these days when it comes to trying to give this guy a little bit more, and that means this guy gets a little bit less to make it all add up in the course of your overall bonus pool.
All right, let's shift focus a little bit to the current edition of the Blue Jays as they get set to face the Yankees tonight. Masahiro Tanaka against Clayton Richard. You know, that last road trip was difficult to watch. There wasn't a lot that went on positively for that team, although I would, you know, I at the risk of sounding like a shill, I'm going to continue to pound the drum and say that I have been impressed by what I've seen from Vladdy Jr., his ability to stay in the field, his ability to make some plays. And Kevin Biggio certainly comes as advertised when it comes to having an eye at the plate. But, you know, my question is, Marcus Stroman's comments after his start about the attitude in the clubhouse and how difficult it's going to be to keep it up. Look, I completely understand where Marcus is coming from there. I have no issue with him saying that. I know some people are trying to make it into a, you know, there's Marcus Stroman being Marcus Stroman again. I don't have any problem with anything he said. But my concern, Ben, is, you know, one of the things that we were told, all of us around this team, was that there was going to be a focus was going to be on getting Vladdy up here and getting him and some of these young guys and surrounding them with the right atmosphere, that was going to be important. Now, a lot of that comes from Charlie Montoya, but a lot of it is also something that is just going to happen organically. How concerned should we be about just the tone and tenor of things around this team right now?
That's a really interesting question. I think when you're looking at the next 4 months in a team that's currently on pace to lose more than 100 games and a player who's so central to the future hopes of this franchise in Vlad Jr., I don't think you want him to be in a 105 loss atmosphere for 5 months of the season. I don't see how that really helps, especially when moving up the system, he was in winning environments at Dunedin, at New Hampshire, winning league titles in those spots on his way up through the minor leagues. So certainly you'd want to continue that. And yeah, I don't think that Marcus Stroman's comments are a problem either. I think that that's probably a reflection of where things are at with this team, because even before they went on the road, there was some, you know, frustration that they weren't playing better and they weren't scoring more runs. And that's something that the players are well aware of. The coaches are well aware of. Marcus Stroman isn't saying anything that would surprise anyone around the team. And I wasn't with them on the road trip, so I can't speak to exactly what's going on, but you look at what happened on the field and it's pretty clear that would just add to the frustration. So, you know, I think that I don't know exactly what you do, and I don't know that there's much that they can do, because certainly they're going to lose a lot of games this year and Vlad Jr. is going to be around. So you just have to believe in the people that are there, whether it's Charlie Montoya, the coaches, the training staff, any kind of support staff that you have around, because it can become a grind for these guys if they're losing as much as they are.
What does Charlie Montoya, what does he have to do here? I mean, you know, I'm not saying that there's any magical elixir or anything, but this is a pretty, this is going to be a pretty good test for Charlie, isn't it? Because, you know, again, fairly or unfairly, a lot of this year, and Charlie's career is going to be judged by how Vladdy Jr. acclimates himself to the majors and ultimately how his career is.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, is trying to make sure that these young players, as they arrive in the major leagues, have everything they need to succeed. So that's everything from you know, the right translator to the right food, the right amount of rest, as we've seen become a topic in recent weeks. So all of that is stuff that Montoyo can influence. And whether it's Bivio, whether it's Trent Thornton, Vlad Jr., they have a lot of rookies on this team. And so that's a big part of what happens. And he really can't do much more with, you know, say the starting rotation and the state that it's in. If you're throwing Clayton Richard and Edwin Jackson at the Yankees, as the Blue Jays are this week, chances are the Yankees are going to score a lot of runs, because that's what we've seen the Yankees do against even some elite pitching. And that's, you know, that's not something that Charlie Montoyo can necessarily prevent. He's just got to try to minimize the bleeding, try to manage tactically to the best of his ability in the meantime. But, you know, I don't know that you can put much of this season on Montoyo, really. It's just he's dealt a hand that doesn't have nearly enough talent to compete with the Yankees and Red Sox.
Do you think the Jays maybe miscalculated a bit in the free agent market, given what's still out there and given the success we've seen players have this year after not signing huge contracts? I mean, I'm thinking of Michael Brantley. And look, I understand Michael Brantley's not going to be a long-term answer for this organization. But you know what? I'd take him in. I don't think he's the type of guy that's going to necessarily stop anybody's advancement anyhow, because, one, I don't think this organization has a surplus of outfielders to be pressing him. And, two, he's a guy who can play every position if you want to move him in the outfield. He can play left. He can play center. He can play right. And I understand he's a free agent, so he would have had to choose to come here. But do you think maybe the Jays were a little too cautious in that market this year? And I understand this is hindsight, but do you think that they may have been?
Yeah, I think, well, certainly you look at this roster, there's room for more pitching. I mean, they clearly would benefit from having more major league caliber starting pitching on this team. So I had thought going into the winter that Yusei Kikuchi would have been a really nice pickup. He's doing okay with the Mariners now. I mean, he hasn't been great, but I still think that that would have been a nice pickup. Lance Lynn was another one. The Blue Jays checked on him, but never got a deal done. He's been really good in the last month or so for the Rangers. So that's another one. Of course, Martin Perez, you look at what he's doing in Minnesota. He was a free agent. So those are the types of names that, you know, I do think you look at the free agents they did sign. Matt Shoemaker, that's a good deal. Freddie Galvis, that's a good deal. So you like those contracts, mm-hmm. but it's just not enough, because there's so much attrition. There's so much. And we know this. I mean, Clayton Richard even made the point after his first start here. Like, this isn't a Toronto thing. This isn't a Blue Jays thing. This is just Major League Baseball, that the Blue Jays are experiencing all these injuries, and you need to have the depth in place to deal with those. And in a lot of cases this year, the Jays haven't had enough.
What are you hearing down at AAA in terms of other players who may be, you know, who may be ready to come up here? I'm thinking in particular of Anthony Alford. I know he was hurt, but my understanding was he was sort of clawing his way back to statistical respectability. What do you think is next for the Jays in terms of their organization?
Yeah, Alford is definitely a name to watch. And you look at the last 10, 15 games, hitting around 300 OPS, right back around 800. So, you know, I think at this point with him, you don't necessarily even need him to be playing every single day to justify him being in the majors. You know, where that might have been the case a couple of years ago, you just want to make sure that he's getting, you know, 5, 6, 7 starts a week. I think at this point, if he was in the majors and starting 3 or 4 days, that would be enough. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I would look for Anthony Alford. And, you know, another player to watch with the Bisons will be Bo Bichette, because he ended up fracturing his hand, I want to say April 23rd. So that would put him at about 6 weeks right now. And last I heard, the Jays hadn't determined exactly when he was going to start a rehab assignment, but you have to imagine that that will take place pretty soon and get him back to the Bisons and AAA not long after that.
Now, we mentioned the Yankees are in town for the first of three games tonight. Where do you begin with the Yankees? They are, they've absolutely owned this division. You can't put it any other way from the start of the season till now. The Jays haven't faced them. They're starting to get healthy. Didi Gregorius could be with the team on Friday. Aaron Judge is working out down in Tampa. Dellin Betances is pitching an extended spring. So they're getting closer and closer to being a little more, to looking a little more like the Yankees we thought we were going to see this year. Ben, they're awfully good. And Rick Porcello made the point this weekend, Boston Red Sox, when they were in town, that he said, look, I don't think we've closed the gap on them. You know, he wasn't waving the white flag, but he was essentially saying that, you know, he's starting to look around for it at least. This has been, and I'm not going to lay it all at the feet of Aaron Boone, but this has been one of the best New York stories we've seen in a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, to do this with the amount of injuries that they've had is pretty impressive because, you know, we see it every year. There are often teams that have a few injuries and then just can't recover. But for the Yankees to get this kind of production from Luke Voit and Gio Urshela and DJ LeMahieu, I mean, it's kind of crazy that the second and third wave production that they're getting from guys. Domingo Germán, I mean, you go up and down the roster and there are contributors from expected places like Gary Sanchez, who's supposed to be a star, and then unexpected places. So that's what you need. I mean, we saw that here in 2015 and 16 when you had Ryan Goins and Chris Colabello going off. And sometimes you need that. You need those unexpected guys to step up. But that's what's happening now for the Yankees. And it's pretty crazy to think that the Blue Jays haven't played them yet. I mean, 18 games, six series from this Blue Jays team against that Yankees team. I mean, it's that'll pad the Yankees record potentially from here to the end of the year.
Yeah, I was going to say that the Jays at this point, I think the Jays are in a position where they need to start looking over their shoulders at the Baltimore Orioles a little bit. And that's something I didn't think I'd be saying this year. But I mean, they're what? They're three up in the Orioles, two and a half, three up in the Orioles. That would be a bit of a psychological blow to wake up one morning and find out that you're behind the Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah, it would. And it's not that far off, three games away. I mean, that's one series in Baltimore. I think they play them next week on their road trip. So watch out. It's not anything that I think anyone expected around the Toronto Blue Jays this year, but things are not going well.
Yeah. By the time the Jays meet Baltimore, I'm sure our friend Dwight Smith Jr. will have about 15 home runs. Ben, thanks for doing this. See you at the yard.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jeff.
Ben Nicholson-Smith is baseball editor of Sportsnet.ca, co-host of our At the Letters podcast, along with Arden Swelling. The Jays back home. They've got six games at home, three against the Yankees, three against the Arizona Diamondbacks, who are a really fun team to watch. They're a real growing concern, a going concern, I should say, and a growing concern. They've got an awful lot of draft picks in this particular draft, and that is an organization that taken a step back, but it's not going to be that long before they're back near the front of the pack again. So the Yankees will play three here. The Arizona Diamondbacks come in for three. It'll be Masahiro Tanaka against Clayton Richard tonight. Blue Jay Central, 6:30 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario and Sportsnet 1. First pitch just after 7 on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet Ontario. And as always, Blue Jays talk with Scott MacArthur right after the final out on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. The Blue Jays making a move yesterday, sending down Justin Schaefer, and ahead of tonight's game, which, as I mentioned, will be started by Clayton Richard at 7 o'clock at the Rogers Center. The Yankees 38-20. They are absolutely cruising in the American League East. I was looking at the numbers yesterday. I believe the breakdown is they have put as many players on the DL so far this year as they had all of last year. I'm sorry, they're two away. They've used the DL almost as much as they did last year. So, it will be and as I said, they're getting healthier, and that's a scary thought because the Jays have all their games against the Yankees remaining. You know, talk about a weird schedule. We are what? This will be the 60th game of the year for the Jays, and they have yet to face the New York Yankees. Bizarre indeed. Ronnie Nunn is founder of Nunn Better Refs. He's a former NBA referee and director of officials. A lot of talk in this city about how game two of the NBA Finals was officiated. I've said I really didn't have that much of a big deal with it. There were a couple of ticky-tack fouls, I thought, on Kyle Lowry, but by and large, I thought Kyle Lowry put himself in a position to foul out. That is exactly what happened. How different is refereeing in the playoffs compared to refereeing in the regular season? And I want to ask Ronnie Nunn about this last two-minute report, right? And we've talked about this. Every NBA game, there's a last two-minute report. The most recent one from Game 2, and essentially what it is it's a review of the last 2 minutes of the game, and it basically says what the referees did right and what they got wrong. There were a couple of foul calls or a couple of traveling calls against the Raptors that were missed. But also, when the report says right there on the game-winning shot and the deciding shot, if not the game-winning shot and the deciding three-pointer, Steph Curry did, in fact, travel. I understand we all like transparency. I'm just not certain that the general public needs to know that the league thinks a referee has blown a call. I don't see how that serves anybody's best interest. We'll find out what Ronnie Nunn thinks about it. We'll talk some NBA officiating. It's the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Jim and Sid, so funny, you might pee a little. Luckily, you can listen on the can. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Definition of depressing is I was covering a Tampa Bay Rays Blue Jays game at the Trop. The post game concert was MC Hammer. Former bat boy for the Oakland Athletics, by the way. That's why we're playing Oakland and San Francisco music. All I remember was, you know how empty Tropicana Field normally is? There were people, and this is the truth, there were more people to see MC Hammer. When he came, people started coming into the stadium to see MC Hammer, and like the seventh inning of the of the Rays game was awful. Like the attendance actually went up. People. Anyhow. Well, I mean, it wasn't bad. It's MC Hammer. The Raptors are in Oakland, along with the Golden State Warriors, ahead of Game 3 of the best of 7 NBA Finals, which we will have Wednesday on Sportsnet Ontario. Tim and Sid will get you set at 6 o'clock. Basketball Central at 8:30 p.m. The tip-off will be just after 9 with Matt, Leo, and Eric. And we'll have our Raptors pregame show, The Wrap, presented by Comda.com with Russick and Marchese right after the final horn on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Officiating, very much a topic of conversation in this city after Game 2. Of course, it's always going to be a conversation in any city that has a player foul out in the playoffs, in the finals. That was the case with Kyle Lowry. And as I've said, really, I had maybe an issue with one call on Kyle Lowry. I certainly had no issue in the call that saw Kyle Lowry foul out of the game. I thought happened right in front of me. I thought it was pretty blatant. By and large, I think the officiating, at least the officiating the Raptors have received in this series has been pretty good. Or I'm sorry, in the postseason has been pretty good. It's been pretty fair. I mean, yes, ref, you suck. We're going to hear those chants all the time at Scotiabank Arena. That's just part of the deal here in Toronto. But I thought on balance, the Raptors have received fair to favorable officiating in the postseason. I have to tell you, the use of video review in that Philadelphia and Milwaukee series absolutely played into the Raptors' hands. In the case of the Milwaukee series, it was as good as an extra timeout on a couple of occasions for Kawhi Leonard late in the game. So we talk about officiating during the regular season and officiating during the postseason. And I've always wondered about officiating in the postseason because, unlike the regular season, you are officiating the same two teams. And I understand the crews changed, but by and large, you've got two teams that are facing each other within a span of 2 weeks. They're two of the best teams in the league. In this case, they're the two surviving teams. We can call them the best teams in the league. They've got some of the best players in the league. You've got familiarity of videotape. You've got familiarity of, I'm going to call it, hand-to-hand combat. How difficult is it to officiate a series like this? Ronnie Nunn is founder of Nunn Better Refs. He's a former NBA referee and director of officials. And Ronnie Nunn joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Ronnie, thanks so much for joining us this morning. How difficult is it to officiate a series in the playoffs? Because, as I said, you've got two teams that are going to be playing against each other in a short period of time. A lot of grudges. Everybody knows everybody's intricacies. How difficult is it to officiate that compared to a regular season game where two teams are going to meet and then they may not meet again for another month? They're going to go on and play somebody else the next night.
You know, Jeff, thanks for having me. It's a great series. You can see that it's going to be a great series. It's a great time in basketball. But I will tell you that whatever decade we're in, a series action is intense because it's intense. The coaches need to make changes almost on every game. The players know the strengths and weaknesses of the other team. The coaches, again, make the changes. And the officials keep up with the changes, and sometimes they see them anew. Mm-hmm. So as coaches make changes, all of a sudden the second game is never like the first game. And as the games go on, you've got to recognize nuances in the game, changes. A player changes game tempos, substitutions that come in and create a different type style of play. It becomes very difficult. And number one is the defense is tighter in most cases. Postseason defense is tighter. Hence, there's more fouls. And by the way, there's more careless fouls. And I saw a lot of those as well.
Define a careless foul to me.
Well, you know, two of the real interesting fouls. I got a group of fouls called Nunn's Nine. There are the nine most prominent fouls that players make, and as a result, officials need to target them and be better at making those decisions. One of them is obviously the strip foul. I mean, you can live and die on the strip foul. If you're going to strip a ball, then you want to be really clear you can get to it and not take a careless, you know, a strip to it. And what comes to mind right away is Lowry's last play in which he made a strip. Here's a tremendous athlete, tremendous player, full of passion, pride, and skill set. And he just goes after something at one time, and definitely at a time when it's critical. You just got to be careful on strips. So the same with swipes on plays going to the hoop where bigs, instead of being vertical and changing the trajectory of her shot, they go and try to block it. And I worked with a team one season. I had a program called New Hoops IQ, and the IQ piece is the key. I mean, use your IQ and what you're trying to do to make teams miss their shot or not be careless on your fouling tendencies.
Mm. How much do teams? I mean, look, we know that the rules change every year, Ronnie. We should say they're tweaked every year. How much do teams pay attention to rules changes in training camp? And they do have a session. I know they have the media has a session with officials very early in the season where they get anybody who wants to come in can get together, can meet with the officials, and there's a discussion about a point of emphasis. How often does that happen in the regular season, and how often will it happen during the playoffs?
Well, certainly at the beginning of the season, I was part of that, and I enjoyed being the maitre d' of that during the time when journalists and TV media, radio and TV media, and all folks that announce our games come in to learn better so they can announce better. I think that's just a great interaction, along with coaches having a great interaction time with the management group from the NBA. But during the season, you set your point of emphasis, and sometimes people believe, well, we'll see how the guys will call it. And it's a growing type thing. It takes a season for people to understand that this is the hand check they're going to call, or this is the post play that we want to assume to call, because it cleans the game up. We've done that over the years, and it continues. During the playoffs, you get a review of that again. Memos are sent out that, you know, the game is going to be the same, and it is. The problem is the players are more impassioned, and they are more tight on defense. The space between them, whether on or off the ball, creates more contact situations, which makes it tougher. And also, you have to also lift the line or widen the line to marginal versus illegal contact. And I don't like the expression when people say, you know, in an NBA game, you can call a foul anytime you want to. It's really not true. There are marginal contacts that are permissible and legal, and those marginal contacts sometimes are a little bit thicker and tougher in a playoff play.
Mm-hmm. And again, that gets to the point because, you know, there is a familiarity. Guys are playing up and on each other. You essentially do have to give the players a little bit of leeway. And you know what happens? Like, Ronnie, and I know I'm guilty of this, a lot of times I look around and I'll say, you know, well, I mean, the star player gets the benefit of the doubt. But as I had someone tell me, well, Jeff, who the hell has the ball in their hand during the postseason more often than not? Guess who? The star player, right?
Yeah. There's another piece to that star player stuff. Star players, actually, in my experience, both on the floor and in directing our guys, star players actually don't get as many calls as they should. And I don't think people realize that. And the reason is they are so able to create and finish. They can convert whatever they do. If they're rebounders, scorers, shooters, drivers to the hole and passing to open people, the hits sometimes and the contacts that occur, they finish so well that you have to look twice and say, you know, did he really get hit or not? And we're not even talking about the bigs, dominant bigs that I played like Shaquille or Kareem or Moses Malone or Akeem Olajuwon. I mean, these guys finish. Michael Jordan finishes. LeBron James finishes. By the way, Kyle Lowry finishes. The great Kawhi Leonard finishes. And yet sometimes contacts are missed on that marginal tone. And then when you look at it in review, you go, geez, I would have liked to have a whistle on that. He deserves one. So there's the other side of that coin about star players.
I wanted to ask you about the last minute report, or the last 2 minute report that comes out. You know, we saw one for game two, where it was broken down that, you know, Steph Curry had in fact traveled on the game winning shot, and that there were a couple of other travels missed. And here's my point, Ronnie. You know, I mean, I love transparency. I think transparency is great. But I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of a referee, and I wouldn't mind if the NBA, you know, if I got a call in the morning or I got an email saying, okay, here's our report and what you did, you know, in the last minute, this was missed, this was missed, this was missed. I don't know if I really want fans knowing that. Like, what purpose does that serve by making it that public? To me, it's almost an unnecessary thing.
You know, the last 2 minute report should be an internal report. And I think you begin to recognize who your chieftains in officiating are when you do it internally. And I mean it by saying how good you are under the highest pressure in the game. And that should be internal. And everybody understands what it is. And everybody knows who's really doing well at it. And also everybody knows how to get better at it.
Right.
When it goes out to the public, I don't really think it serves a lot. Now, one of the keys for that, because there's a reason for it, is the NBA wants to be transparent. I mean, when I was a director, I learned a lot of things that I didn't know when I was actually officiating. The immense pressure, the immense validity, the immense accountability that the office is trying to maintain. And so we didn't want to have a hidden type of thing. So I think that's where it came out. It didn't come in my era, but I think it came out after we did it internally because, you know, teams would call up, complaints would call up, coaches, GMs. We'd be having a conversation about this play, that play, and sometimes there were wars. Sometimes they were absolutely correct in their problem issues, areas with us. But the bottom line is the fans, the journalists would write things, and I think it was a reason for transparency. Let it get out there the last 2 minutes, and let's see how, you know, people know that we're telling the truth. It's really about trying to tell the truth more than trying to undermine the officials. I don't think it doesn't make it good for the guys in general, because you know what you're doing wrong internally, and you know you got to get better, because I think people don't realize there's a great pride in wanting to be very good. It's a great pride in throwing strike in that ninth inning of the game especially. And, you know, everything is datarized in a way. So we try to throw as many strikes as we can then. And you got to do that internally. So when you get out in the open, it works better. I think showing it to the public, the right reasons for transparency, but the wrong reason is I think it breaks down the men and ladies' ability to strike this chord correctly.
He is founder of None Better Refs. He's former NBA referee and director of officials, Ronnie Nunn, joining us on the Jeff Blair Show. Ronnie, we know that not just basketball, but hockey, baseball, every sport in North America is moving more and more towards a closer relationship with legalized gambling. A couple of states just this past week cleared it. There's some talk in Ontario about legalized sports gambling. How concerned are not just NBA officials, but the officials in other sports you talk about or you talk to about the added pressure that will come with legalized gambling?
You know, that's an interesting question. And to be frank and maybe simply said, I really don't think the officials are going to be involved with any of that thing that's so profound now and out in the open compared to when it was hidden.
Right.
Maybe because it's profoundly out there. The bottom line is for the officials in all these sports is I like to use baseball as an analogy because it was my first love before I got to basketball. It's a matter of calling strikes and balls, and you've got to have the strike, you know, your strikes in there. And whoever's betting this or betting that, your adversary is making those calls. It's not Team A or Team B. The adversary of your work is incorrect decisions, and they can overwhelm you. They can put you to lose some of your reputation. They can demote you on a staff, and they can fire you from a staff. By the same token, they can promote you and increase the amount of confidence and in you to take on the biggest games that sport has. So the officials are focused on calling plays correct every time. I can't tell you the amount of times we've all come home and not slept well when you needed to sleep because you had to work the next day because you weren't happy with your performance. And sometimes the players save you. They have great games. They come out of it. The game finishes, and all of a sudden there's less of a highlight on the officiating at a certain time. So you know, those times I'm appreciative of as well because it's the player's game. But when it comes to making sure that you're managing that game correctly, according to guidelines, understanding of the game, contact situations, violation situations that are obvious, you know, those are internalized and taken home, taken back to the crew as they review. So much review is done today. And by the way, a credit to the instant replay review, which has obviously raised the level of strikes being thrown correctly, because there is a review for such tough plays. As I've always said, the toughest play is not block charge, it's out of bounds plays. The flicks of those balls are really tough. And we had one in this game, by the way, I know with Gasol, I think, being properly changed around for a call in which he did not touch an errant ball that was deflected.
Right. Ronnie, we're going to let you run. Great to talk to you. Really enjoyed it. Terrific insight.
Great, Jeff. Great to be with you. And congratulations to Toronto at the level they've done it. International basketball is something I've been involved with since my retirement. And it's really a joy to see how the game is building up. And no greater than right up the block here from the U.S. and Canada. I hope more teams come along up there. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you, Ronnie. Take care. Ronnie Nunn is founder of Nunn Better Refs. He's a former NBA referee and director of officials. What a great comment. Your adversary, the adversary of your work, is incorrect decisions if you're an official. So hopefully we've given you a little bit of insight into that. And I'm glad to see that I'm not the only one who doesn't like the idea of the last two-minute report. I think it's an unnecessary, as a journalist, you're all, well, I mean, I guess I'm sometimes a journalist. You're all for transparency and all that stuff, and you're all for all the information being made available. But I got to tell you, there are things that I think I can do without as a fan, and the last two-minute report is one of them. I would much rather that report be kept in the purview of the officials and the NBA head office. I don't think it adds to anything. It only makes a referee's job harder, and it increases the anxiety for reporters and fans. That is it for us. Hockey Central at noon is next. Don't forget, Yankees and Blue Jays tonight, 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a great day.